Hello and welcome to our call for a follow-up. It's actually a bonus for those who came to Shine and did the VIP option. And this is a guest experts call on lab testing. And we have two very special guests this evening. We have, to start off the evening, we're going to have a chat with Dr. Tracy. Michael McAvoy, who is he runs a company called Metabolic Healing, and he does the most amazing genetics test. I absolutely love his genetics test, and we're going to learn more about that and about genetic testing in general tonight. So Michael is the founder and CEO of Metabolic Healing. He's a creator of 4 clinical training programs, as well as the creator of the Metabolic Healing Functional Blood Chemistry Analyzer and the Nutrigenomics Reports. And I, like I said, I haven't used the Functional Blood Chemistry yet, but I absolutely love the Nutrigenomics Reports. It's one of the most comprehensive ones out there and really helps you to be able to understand the complexities of nutrigenomics and how you could use them in making clinical decisions. So tonight, Michael is going to be discussing ways of integrating genetic test results into your practice. So Michael, hello. I'm so happy to have you here.
Hey, Rita Marie, thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, you were at Shine. Those of you who were at Shine, you remember meeting Michael probably at his booth and chatting with him, and he was very active during our talks, and he did a little talk at Shine as well, but it was a short talk, and I knew that there was more that he could cover that I wanted to hear more of, and so we invited him to come and join us for this guest expert call. So, you know, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and why you're so into this genetic testing stuff,
I've been doing this healthcare stuff for the last 10 years or so. And, you know, over the last 5 to 6 years, there's literally been an explosion of information about genetics in general. And since the mapping of the human genome, we now have the availability to do direct-to-consumer testing of our own genome. And that's just remarkable because that opens up a lot of different possibilities of what we can do. And so one of the things that I've been very active in doing in my practice is getting into this research of genetics and trying to figure out how genetic testing at the onset of the 21st century is really useful clinically and what is some of the limitations are, but what some of the strengths are as well. And we have to really be aware of both of those. And so, in my opinion, genetic testing has a potential to really elucidate and elaborate on problems that are happening in the body that we wouldn't necessarily be aware of. But some of the problems with this is specifically that we are often kind of led to believe that the only thing that matters is genetics, and we have to trust that genes kind of regulate, and that's kind of been the dogma since the 1960s in science and in medicine, is that, well, you know, your mom had heart disease, that means you're going to have heart disease. We can't explain your problem, and so we'll just blame it on genetics. But meanwhile, they don't actually go into, when you hear that kind of dogma, they don't actually go into talking about what genes are necessarily involved. So all of that is changing because now we have the ability to start scanning different parts of our genome and to actually begin conducting investigations on these different parts of the genome that could be strengths and weaknesses depending upon how you look at it. And so there's a lot of other people in the field that are doing this kind of, you know, as they say, biohacking of your genes, and how the use of genetic testing can be very valuable when you're trying to figure out what's wrong with somebody, but also realizing we have to understand what the limitations of genetics are, and largely that, you know, I like to tell people that your genetics are simply more like a noun. Your biochemistry is more like a verb. And by that, I mean that your genes, they don't actually do anything. They're like a gigantic instruction manual, but the instruction manual is basically not operative in and of itself. It's only like a template. And so the body can copy the template into something usable, and that's your RNA and the proteins that get made from the RNA. But we have to realize that your genetic expression can switch on, can switch off. And just because you see certain, you know, quote unquote mutations in certain genes doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything that's wrong with that. And in some senses, it's actually more desirable in some cases to have certain gene mutations And some, you know, because of the fact that certain genes could be good for one thing but bad for something else.
Yeah.
So we have to be able to look at all of these different things and figure out how to kind of make sense of it all on an individual basis.
All right. So there's a lot of places, there's a lot of things I want to have you elaborate on for people, because I think it's really important. A lot of the things you just said, because of the belief that some people have that, okay, it's just my genes, right? Or they do the test and it's, they think it means that they have this specific deficiency, as opposed to that it means that they have a tendency towards that and that they need to watch the lifestyle and the epigenetic modulation factors that can be involved there. So I want to just talk briefly about something that I see a lot of, and I want to kind of dispel the myth and have you help dispel the myth of, is the this or that approach. Second, somebody just
right, unmuted.
This for that, and then I'll unmute you because somebody just came in unmuted for whatever reason, and it's making noise. Okay, unmute. There you are. Okay, talk, Mike.
Yeah.
No, good. Sorry.
Yeah. So this kind of this for that approach, and that's, you know, always kind of when new systems kind of develop, and I should just point out and reiterate again that this science of genetics and the implications of genetics on human health is an ever-evolving process. And quite honestly, we're at the very beginning stages of even beginning to understand what genetics is even doing. But a lot of times when we're looking at genetics, there's this kind of almost reductionist approach saying, well, okay, I've got an MTHFR gene. That means I need to take methylfolate, and that's the first and most important thing. Or let's just look at another gene and say, oh, I'm COMT++. I need to start taking more S-adenosylmethionine. That kind of approach doesn't work necessarily because it doesn't take into account all of the different factors that are influencing your requirement for those particular nutrients. So what I try to do instead is to say, let's look at particular biochemical pathway. Let's just take, for example, the genes that modulate your sex hormones, like estrogen, for example. We can screen and evaluate a particular biochemical pathway, and that will give us a little bit more of a clear understanding of what kind of biochemical tests would be useful to evaluating that pathway. So this is something that I've been doing a lot of research in as of late, is estrogen genetics. Mm. And, you know, and obviously estrogen comes with a bad connotation because of the link to certain cancers and such. So there's a desired interest to start looking at these kinds of things. But to try to avoid that kind of clinical reductionism, it's important to try to match the symptomatology as well as the clinical tests that have been run already with the genetics to kind of get a three-dimensional picture of what's actually happening in the person's, you know, genetic expression. Because that's really what matters the most, is what their genetic expression is right now. So as technology advances and as we begin to, you know, look at more kinds of tests and the availability of certain tests becomes more, you know, open, we'll learn more about how to better evaluate genetic expression. That's really where the gold is being able to say, let's look at the genetics plus clinical history plus actual lab tests. And that will give us a more three-dimensional view, rather than saying, you've got this gene mutation, just take this. You've got that mutation, just do that.
Yeah.
Again, that kind of approach is more one or two dimensional.
Exactly. That makes total sense. So tell people a little bit, you know, people hear MTHFR and people are, they're doctors, like a lot of medical doctors, that's what they do. They know MTHFR. Oh, you've got an MTHFR. I'm going to put you on 5,000 milligram or micrograms of methylfolate. And that's all they know. And I would love to just have you talk a little bit about some of those interactions that just that reductionistic approach might create for somebody.
Like, yeah. Well, that's a great point. And you know, as holistic healthcare practitioners, we're all aware of the need to keep a bigger view, you know, an open mind about the bigger picture view, if you will. And you know, in medicine, there's kind of this already existing reductionism that prevails medical thinking for the most part. And that's even reflected in now, you know, you can have a doctor or your physician run an MTHFR gene test through Quest or LabCorp, and then it'll come back as either, you know, whatever, plus, 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 minus, or minus, minus for each of those variants. But that still isn't really enough to information. I mean, it's like, let's look at the smallest possible fragment, and then let's try to make some sort of a reasonable guess about what to do based on that. It just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So at least, you know, with something like 23andMe or some of these other companies, you're able to screen for much larger, vast, you know, a much vaster array of different genes and their variants. So, you know, and you have basically a lot of people that are saying, oh, you've got the MTHFR gene mutation, let's just load you up on huge doses of methylfolate. And that approach never works because, you know, when you do that, you're going to start overloading your glutamate system. And it's probably one of the main reasons why people develop hyper sympathetic nervous system symptoms and anxiety and things like this and agitation. So you have to kind of look more at the bigger picture of, so just specifically with MTHFR, you know, you want to look at, first of all, just from a genetic perspective, what are all of the other genes that are related to MTHFR in that pathway? And so I think Dr. Rita Marie does a very good job of that from the presentations that I've seen, helping to kind of really shed light on the importance of looking at this pathway holistically rather than individually. And that gives a better sense of where the key nutrients will be found. But then you can use biochemical tests to help validate the use of a particular nutrient as well as symptomatology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while it's important, while folate is certainly important, and, you know, I'd say pregnancy in the first trimester of pregnancy, the importance of folate is probably the greatest during this point because of, you know, folate's need for DNA synthesis and you're forming a new fetus. So there's always arguments to make for and against something. In the instances where if I'm working with somebody that has cancer or a client that has an autoimmune disease, rather than trying to promote methylation, I'm actually trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to shut it down until we can get the inflammatory processes under control. So being able to know the whens and whys and the do's and the don'ts are really important when it comes to methylation and MTHFR in general.
So you mentioned 23andMe. I think most people know what 23andMe is. It's a genetic test where you can run, what is it, like 600,000 SNPs, I think?
Yeah, it's something like that. It's a few hundred thousand, and most of those there really isn't any research on yet.
Right. And people want to go through and go, oh, my God, what does this mean and what does that mean? And they get freaked out when they look at some of these reports with lots of red. So I love your report, and I'd love you to speak a little bit about how did you come to do this and talk a little bit about, you know, the interpretations that you do provide, because I really love the way you've packaged it.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of different companies that are out there that will do an analysis of your 23andMe results, and there's always, you know, strengths and weaknesses to all these reports. And what I did is I said, well, let's instead of just providing an endless list of different genes with really no other information, I wanted to create a report that has a description of every gene that's in the report with links and backlinks and hyperlinks to at least some kind of research that helps the person to you know, learn more about what the gene does and what it's for. So that was kind of the foundation. I wanted to create more of a research project that is able to be, you know, followed up on by the user. So the way that I have the report structured is I basically am trying to look at genes in particular biochemical pathways so that we can start to learn more about the interaction of these genes in these pathways. So, for example, you know, I have sections on different parts of the immune system. I have sections in the report that are specific just to methylation. I have sections in the report that are specific to estrogen metabolism, parts of the report that are related to digestion and various digestive functions, mitochondrial-related genes. So by looking at it this way, rather than just a whole pile of different genes, it gives you kind of a better sense of evaluating whole systems. So again, I'd like to use the example of the estrogen section because one of the things that I've done is I've paired the urinary sex hormone testing side by side with the section on estrogen genetics. And I look to see what the strengths and weaknesses are and how much of these genes that we're seeing are being expressed. You know, and so that's one of the other things that I've done, and one of the areas of research I want to keep focusing on are different ways to integrate genetics with functional lab testing. And that's kind of where I was going with creating this report, is that hopefully we'll have enough of that biochemical testing data in the future to be able to really, really get a much deeper view and understanding. So the existing report now is really good. It's like maybe 35 pages long, 40 pages long, and it gives you an evaluation of about 275 or so different genes related to immune function, celiac, methylation, various digestive functions, and estrogen, things like this. And it's more compartmentalized in systems rather than just a long list of individual genes.
Makes it difficult to know where to begin.
Yeah, we always want to be able to, you know, get on top of the latest information. And that's the other thing with genetics, is that there's just such an overwhelming amount of information. It really takes time to sort through it all. And I'm working on creating systems that help to, you know, kind of sort out the most relevant genetic data that's out there and kind of say, well, these kind of studies are better to look at versus these kinds of studies. You know, we're wanting to really find out how can we best determine genetic expression. And because the genetic expression is, again, where it's really where the rubber meets the road. And when we're dealing with chronic illness, when we're dealing with trying to improve health on multiple levels, we need to develop systems that are three-dimensional, that are capable of giving us some direction as clinicians. And that's when I look at a genetic test, I want to use the genetic test to get a good understanding of what is going on with my client. When it gives me genetic information, gives me a basis of evidence of how to start an investigative process.
Mm-hmm. So do you start with that? If you're working with somebody, do you start with running a genetic test? Do you start with other things? Do you then go back and say, hey, they're not responding as I thought they should to whatever we're working on, and now go do a genetic test? I'd love to get your opinion. I know there's a lot of opinions on that. And where to go with it?
Yeah, there are a lot of opinions on that, and honestly, I don't always start with genetics first. It's very rare that I do, although we have a lot of clients that contact us that already have done 23andMe. Mm. So it winds up that in that circumstances, we're winding up looking at genetics anyway, just because people see our site and they see what we do and it's related that we have genetics. So it winds up being that way anyway, but I don't necessarily need to look at a genetics test to get going. However, I'd say this, that if I'm dealing with somebody that has a really serious issues going on, I'm definitely going to want to look more at that. If I'm dealing with somebody that has suspected estrogen-related problems, I think it's eventually a good idea to do some genetic work to see what that looks like. If I suspect that somebody has methylation issues, I definitely think it's good to evaluate methylation genes. And, you know, I've run enough of these reports to say, you know, I can pick apart and see, well, it's interesting to see when you have somebody that's really chronically ill, sometimes you see a genetics report with just a lot of really bad configurations. And you can definitely start to see those patterns and how, you know, they're almost predictive in a sense that there's the really easy for that person to be tipped in the wrong direction. So there are ways to kind of see the patterns within the test. And I think it just comes over time with doing enough of these. Mm-hmm. You start to see that.
Yeah.
And so that's a skill in itself.
Yeah.
For sure.
And it's like any other skill for health coaches and practitioners, is repetition. It's just doing things over and over again, and things just start to get second nature. And sometimes I can predict the genetic patterns based on their behaviors, like their, the way they're presenting. I'll often sign, I bet they have patterns because it seems like, or the people that are super sensitive, like the canaries in the coal mine that come in with multiple chemical sensitivities, and you're predicting like a lot of those detox pathways are in question, and that's why they're so sensitive. Like a lot of people, it's very freeing. When they find that out, that they have some of those, like for some people it's like, oh my God, that means I can't be exposed to anything. But others say, oh my God, that explains my whole life. I wasn't a hypochondriac. This is what the issue is. And I really do need to be careful about avoiding these. And I do need to, you know, shore up my detox pathways, et cetera.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I've had a lot of instances where the genetics really did explain a lot of things that were otherwise not explainable. And, you know, I can give examples of how, okay, so even if somebody's MTHFR++, that by itself doesn't necessarily mean that much per se, but if somebody's MTHFR++, COMT++, and CYP1B1++, those three things together could spell trouble. And it could explain lifelong depression. It could explain lifelong chemical sensitivity. It could explain a lot of things. And I've seen patterns in different people with those particular combinations where they definitely seem to be related. So from a clinical perspective, it's interesting because, you know, we're always trying to look and dig deeper. At least I am trying to really understand things and how they fit together. Mm-hmm. And genetics testing definitely can be a teacher in that way. And as you said, it's definitely something that can help the client or patient to understand and explain some of the bigger problems that they've dealt with.
And I find that too, I don't know if you find this too, but I find that a lot of times it's good. I know ammunition is the word that came to mind, probably not the best word, but the good impetus for them to actually be more careful. Oh, look at this. You know, you've got these slips. You're not going to be able to handle these particular environmental toxins. You know, you need to be able to be careful of them. You need to avoid them. And they go, oh, my goodness, yeah, I'll be careful. And then they stop. Or they see a gluten sensitivity gene or an autoimmune, you know, pattern that's potential or gut stuff. And they go, oh, I guess I better be careful. I guess that gut repair that you told me about is really important for me to be doing. So I find that it helps me to get more compliance with people.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with that. And, you know, the other thing that's worth noting and talking about is that, you know, certain gene mutations, let's call them mutations, but the real nomenclature is variations on these S&Ps. You know, these genetic mutations can encode for upregulation in some enzymes and downregulation of other enzymes. And so it's kind of important to kind of know what some of those are, like MTHFR and COMT, for example, are downregulations, but CYP1B1 and 3A4, CYP3A4, those can encode for upregulations. And so being able to
that downregulation, upregulation before you go too far for those who might be confused by that terminology.
Yeah, that's a good, let's elaborate in that. So basically, again, the DNA is it's a template, right? And in the template, the DNA will get converted or transcribed into RNA. So DNA is what you have. RNA is what you use. And then the RNA is then used to make all of these protein enzymes that drive these biochemical processes. Yeah. So those enzymes can be, you know, encoded for being in the function of those enzymes can be either increased or decreased. It just from a purely genetic blueprint standpoint. And so when we talk about gene expression, what we're really trying to figure out is, are those enzymes that the DNA encodes for, is the function of those enzymes high or low? Mm-hmm. And being able to know the difference is potentially significant. And there's obviously a lot of controversy with that, but there are certain situations where that actually can be very relevant. Like to go back to that issue of CYP1B1 and CYP3A4, it seems evident that the risk allele or the quote unquote mutation can encode for an increased function of those genes. And that's potentially problematic, because those genes not only metabolize estradiol and estrogen, but they also encode for the metabolism of environmental chemicals like benzene, styrene, things like this. And so if that gene is upregulated, then it could suggest a higher level of carcinogenic intermediates being produced from that upregulated gene. So like a bad configuration is CYP1B1++ and COMT++, because the CYP1B1 mutation will theoretically increase the function of the enzyme. The COMT++ will theoretically downregulate the function of the enzyme. And so the potential problem is that you're going to get more, again, purely from a genetic standpoint, you're encoded to get more carcinogenic intermediates and less ability to methylate and detoxify them. Mm-hmm. So when I see those kinds of configurations, I want to pay attention to them, and I want to screen the biochemistry. So I'll run a Dutch test, for example, or urine sex hormone test, to get a better understanding of what's happening in that pathway, and then do an environmental screen on my client to see what's in their house, what kind of cosmetics they're wearing, what kind of chemicals that are in their environment. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just reading, just on that note, I was just reading about some research showing the level of environmental chemicals that are released during airplane travel.
Oh, yeah.
And simply because it's unbelievable how much, and this is like a big dark secret of the airlines industry, is that everyone's breathing in these toxic carcinogenic petrochemicals because the manufacturers of the engine technology, just get back to the 1950s and 60s, never developed a way to filter out the chemicals from the air that you're breathing in on the planes. So these things are just, one of the many problems that we have to deal with in the 21st century regarding toxicity. And our genetic expression can definitely be affected by these environmental toxins. And as Dr. Rita Marie talked about, this is the field of epigenetics in learning about gene expression. So it ties back into your genetic inheritance, but it bleeds into how we can evaluate and the need to evaluate gene expression and what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you say that if two things that come out from what you just said, one is, when we get people and we do it, we really always need to do a thorough history to understand what's going on with a person. And when you do that, and they may be somebody who says, yeah, but every time I fly cross country, I'm sick for days. I have jet lag or whatever. Maybe it's not jet lag. Maybe they have some of these dysregulations, these SNPs that code for poor metabolism of these toxins. And every time they travel, they're just getting sicker and they're putting a load on their liver. So that's one thing to point out. And that's why it's so important that this is a part of clinical history, not the whole thing. Like somebody wants to come in and somebody just wrote in, Lynn just wrote in, when you have somebody with a plus MTRR, A6G, would you recommend methylfolate or folinic acid? And maybe doing it every other day. Also taking SAMe. I'd love to hear your answer, but my answer would be it depends.
Totally depends on a lot of different circumstances. If they have some sort of active autoimmune disease, I'm not going to promote methylation. Even if they have high homocysteine, I'm just going to say let's work on cleaning up your gut first, mm-hmm. and let's reduce the inflammatory burden. Or, in some cases with cancer, I don't promote methylation because, the SAMe and DNA methyltransferase 1 are promoting the tumorigenesis. So there's instances where if there's chronic inflammation already existing, I'm going to not recommend certain methyl donors. But, for general precaution, if somebody's relatively healthy, doesn't have a lot of issues going on, and you see something like high homocysteine, yeah, it's probably a good idea to address that and just to monitor the responses. But, we have to pay attention to all the other cofactors in the pathway, especially vitamin B2, and making sure that you have minerals that are readily usable, like selenium. So there's a lot of different groundwork that needs to be laid down first, for sure.
Yeah. So it's just part of a clinical picture is what I'm getting. And when people are doing, you mentioned the 23andMe, and you mentioned that there are other tests that people are coming in with just testing certain genes. I'm assuming that you are a big fan of doing the full panel versus just doing, like, say, the SpectraCell or the other kind of labs that do these shortened panels.
Yeah, I'm definitely more of a fan of that. The more holistically minded, the more kind of big picture I can get, the better overall. So, you know, there's other tests that could be useful. You know, there's ways of looking at organic acids testing and kind of picking apart the expression of certain genes in there. Even with blood chemistry, to a certain extent, there's availability for that. So I think, you know, I think that eventually we'll get to a point in clinical practice where we can really make a lot more sense of genetic information. Again, as I said before, there's just so much information in our genome that hasn't even been tapped into yet. And once we're able to do that more, I think that things will become a lot more clear.
Right. So what's some takeaways that you have for people, like in terms of genetic testing, for people who want to incorporate it or thinking about incorporating it or already doing it? What are some key things that you'd like to do?
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, I did give everyone that estrogen ebook, which is very valuable. Hopefully everybody gets that download. It's going to tell you a lot about the pathways that are associated with estrogen and what to do. And it'll help you to kind of make sense of certain genes that are there. So that's the one thing. I'd say that if you're wanting to include genetics analysis in your practice clinically, it's good. It's very important to have an open mind about things and to be very skeptical about things, including your own beliefs, and to just be guided by the evidence as best as you can and to learn as much as you can. And also realize that, most importantly, genetics is not the end all be all. It's not the end of the road by any means, but it can be a useful way to evaluate and to even justify some problems that are being experienced by a person. So it's an exploratory thing. It's something that we're all exploring. We're all researchers. I like to think that right now we're living at a time of, this is like the Wild West of science and technology. And it's literally like that. There's so much evolution that's happening right now. It's very much like everyone that gets involved in researching genetics and nutrigenomics, they themselves can become researchers to an extent. And making certain observations themselves about what they've seen in practice. So my suggestion is, if you want to do it, just do it. Get your feet wet. Jump right into it. There's a lot of people out there that are looking for this kind of work, and the more people that get into this market, the more there's a need to really make sense of it and to clarify a lot of the misconceptions that do exist.
Thank you. And I would highly, could you give us a link that people can go and run your test? I would highly recommend that everybody, if you haven't already done your 23andMe, just go out to 23andMe.com. If you use my link /Dr. Riedemer, you'll get $20 off. Run it. If you already have run it, then go to Michael's link and run his report. It's a great starting point because it'll give you a really good overview summary of what the different areas are. And I'd say do it on yourself first, before you start doing it with people.
Yeah, that's a great idea. That's how I learned, is from doing it on myself first and said, wow, I'm COMT++. Well, that explains a lot. That explains why I've got all this dopamine in my brain.
it could be used to the benefit, right? So knowing it will help you when you get into situations where you might be a little bit over the top. It's my, what can I do to calm myself down, calm my brain down here?
Yeah.
Super. So what's the I'll put the link in the chat for everybody. I think it's just metabolichealing.com, right?
Metabolichealing.com /23andme-test-interpretation.
/23andme/, it's all forward slash.
No, it's 23andme. So it's metabolichealing.com /23andme-test.
Yeah.
And then -interpretation.
-interpretation. Okay.
Yeah.
Super. Yeah, I really love it. One of our people, Jamie, who spoke at Shine as well on long distance, he was one of the first recommended your test to me, and I've been using it ever since. So I appreciate it.
Great.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Thanks everybody for all the support, and we're going to continue to develop that report and to add new sections. We have some new interesting sections on immune function that we haven't seen in any other reports before, but
great.
That should be coming in the next few months. So we're looking forward to that.
Fantastic. And I put up the link in here for Michael's gift. He just mentioned his ebook, and I put that link. So it's in the chat. So you can just list it. And it should have also been in the email. I'm not sure if it was. So there you go. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for being here and taking time out of your busy day. I appreciate it. And we'll talk
again. Thanks, Dr. Reader Me, for being here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye-bye, Michael.
All right. Bye.